Speaking of liberty, the National Broadcasting Company presents another in a special series of programs under the auspices of the Council for Democracy. There was free talk in the old New England town hall and round the Cracker Barrel in the Crossroads store. And there is free talk by free men every week at this time, led by our host, Rex Stout. You may already know Rex Stout as the author of intriguing detective stories featuring the master criminologist Nero Wolfe. On this program, you'll get to know him even better as an outspoken champion of our American democracy. Mr. Stout.
Thank you, Howard Tupper. Good evening, friends of liberty. One of the most interesting facts about liberty is that you can keep it only by giving it up. A man's liberty is restricted not only by natural forces such as tigers in India, mosquitoes in a Jersey swamp, and the weather everywhere, but by the limitations necessarily imposed on my liberty in order to preserve yours, and on yours to preserve mine. You are at liberty to drive your car down Fifth Avenue, and I am at liberty to drive mine across 42nd Street, but only on the condition that we stop for a red light, or the two liberties will collide, and as a result, not only our liberties will be damaged, but also our cars and possibly our bones. The whole vast and intricate process of maintaining and managing a democratic society is just that, the constant reconsideration and resolving of that ever-changing problem, how to preserve as true a balance as may be among the bewildering clamor of conflicting interests and desires and ambitions of the 130 million people who are America. The problem of preserving a maximum of all liberties for all people becomes acutely difficult in the case of those special groups whose peculiar relations and disciplines must be accepted. And, of course, the most obvious and most important of these groups is the Army.
Hey!
It is a military necessity for an Army private to surrender a large proportion of the personal liberties which were among his dearest possessions in civilian life.
Hey!
But it is the business of all Army officers from the newest baby lieutenant on up to the commander-in-chief himself...
This, if I may get a word in edgewise... is Wolcott speaking. Barging onto this program, not in my capacity as the town crier, but as one who long ago, back in 1917, 18, and 19, served in the ranks of the American Army. Ever in the Army, Stout?
Salvation.
Really? Were you really in the Salvation Army?
Well, for a couple of hours I was. I sang songs with them, but I...
But you never were in the regular Army.
No, I was in the Navy. That was back when I was a kid.
Ah, during the French and Indian Wars.
No, thank you. It was when Teddy Roosevelt was president. I was assigned to his boat.
His boat?
Sure, the USS Mayflower. I was pay yeoman on the Mayflower.
Yeoman, eh? That's a kind of seagoing non-com, isn't it?
Precisely.
Well, then I can talk to you. I was a sergeant. For some 22 months, I was underfoot in the AEF. And by the time the armistice was signed, I had risen to the rank of sergeant.
Yeah. Influenza, you must have had something on Pershing.
Silence, yeoman. I rose to the rank of sergeant by sheer merit. And if it hadn't been for the armistice...
You'd have been a corporal. But before we go on, let me salute you. I would like to announce that our guest this week is Alexander Wolcott, America's most distinguished jack-of-all-trades, from raconteur to croquet player. Anything else, Sergeant?
Well, I've been a waiter and an actor and a farmhand and a bank clerk.
And a soldier. Carry on.
Well... it's because I was a sergeant once upon a time that I still think of all battles, all armies, all wars, in terms of the enlisted men. I've come to this microphone today because I have something on my mind, and that something is a matter of importance to every sergeant, every corporal, and every buck private in the considerable army we already have, and in the much larger army. Stout, how large an army do you suppose we'll have a year from now?
June 1942. 2 million, 3, 4 million?
Well, speaking of liberty...
I hope you'd get around to that.
Well, speaking of liberty, I want to say a word in their behalf. I want to swap with you some of the thoughts that have been troubling me ever since I came upon a certain feature in a recent issue of Life. It was a small matter.
So is a cracker crumb a small matter, but it can be a nuisance when it gets between the sheets.
Or a grain of dust when it gets in the eye. Well... what disturbed the old sergeant was this article in Life I'm talking about. In that issue, there were printed 14 pencil sketches which had been sent home to his father in England by a young lieutenant. Captured in the fighting on the Somme just a year ago, this lieutenant has ever since been lodged in a Bavarian castle, which is the headquarters in Germany, for some English prisoners they'd taken. Did you see the article I mean?
Yeah, I saw it. For good reasons of their own, the German censors let the drawings cross the lines to reach the boy's father in England.
Yeah, well, after I had looked at the pictures, read through the patch of accompanying text, and glanced at the captions, I threw the magazine from me, but all that day and ever since, I've been haunted by one detail in that feature. One caption in that layout of drawings, which, when I think of it now, still chills me through and through. That was the caption under a drawing showing a small group of British officers, five of them perhaps, at mess. The caption volunteered a further piece of information. I have been plagued ever since by the five words in that caption. Here they are. Servants are captured British soldiers. Those are the five words that haunt me every time I get word that some young neighbor of mine, a boy in the family down the road perhaps, has packed up and gone off to camp. Every time I read in the paper where a new haul of American youth has been picked up in the net of the draft. Servants are captured British soldiers. In other words, here was a group of Englishmen who had gone into battle for their country. Many had been killed. Their outfit, a division, a regiment, a detachment, whatever, had gone through the shattering earthquake of retreat, surrender, and imprisonment. Brothers in the army, brothers in defeat. They were all imprisoned in a Bavarian castle, but even there, the distinction between officers and men was being rigorously observed. That distinction, which has no shadow of excuse, except as it makes an army more efficient, was still going strong in prison. The man in the ranks was being made to wait upon those who in the field had been his superiors. You know, that cracker crumb in my bed, that grain of dust in my eye, has been troubling me ever since. I think it troubled me most because it brought to mind a forgotten historical incident which I stumbled upon in some research I was doing just 20 years ago. I was reading an account of that turbulent century, the 9th, wasn't it? When, after the death of Charlemagne, the Vikings...
The Vikings were the aggressors of their day.
Right. Well, with Charlemagne safely underground, the Vikings, or the Normans, had long overrun the region which we have since been accustomed to call France. Firmly entrenched in that area was ever since been known as Normandy.
That's why it's called Normandy.
Stop showing off. Well, entrenched in Normandy, they used to go to war every spring. One year, I think it was 858, the Burgundians, sallying forth in the spring to do battle with the Norman lords in Aquitania, found their enemy hampered by an uprising of peasants. This rather confused the issue, but not for long. The gentry on both sides, or if you will, the Clibden set on both sides, couldn't stand for any nonsense like that. So they promptly joined forces to put down the uprising before they could go on and have their war in peace.
I see what you mean, but it's not a case in point. There's an analogy there, but it isn't close.
Close enough to make an old sergeant uncomfortable.
Well, an old yeoman, too.
Servants are captured British soldiers, or if you like to reverse the sentence, captured British soldiers are servants. Now let's examine this phenomenon. The Life article said this was a hallowed convention of war.
Well, that's true enough. It is now and always has been.
Life also said that the Germans have a great respect for the conventions of war.
Really?
You took the word right out of my mouth. The Germans have a great respect only for those conventions of war which happen at the moment to suit their convenience. This one does. That's why they're sticklers for this one.
Well, I'm glad you see why the captured Tommies have to wait on their officers hand and foot. It is not because the officers insist on it.
Well, they couldn't.
Exactly. It's because the Germans insist on it.
You see why, don't you?
Sure, I see why. Those prison camps in Germany are run by the German army. The German army is run by its officers. If the captured English soldiers are employed as servants to their officers in that Bavarian castle, it is because the German high command wants the same privileges extended to anti-German officers who may be taken prisoner by the English.
Exactly.
So why are you telling all this to me?
Well, in the hope that a few Americans with nothing better to do at the moment will overhear us. This whole question of the relationship between officers and men is one on which the American people should do a little thinking. The boys who go off to camp, the fathers and mothers who stand in the doorway waving goodbye, more especially the pick of the youngsters who before long will go to special camps as candidates for commissions, most important of all, the commander-in-chief himself, all these, I say, might well do a little thinking about this. A moment ago you said that the German army was run by its officers. So are all armies. So is ours, and all armies, even ours, give occasional proof of their descent from the days before Napoleon created the first citizen army. They're hand-me-downs from a time when all officers were drawn from the gentry, whereas the troops, for the most part, were vagrants picked up along the highway, the scouring of the streets. The officers were gentlemen. The men were not. But the moment we draft an army, all factors change and a new set of obligations goes into effect. It's another story when a democracy goes to war. When we, the people, empower the president to enlarge our armed forces by drawing capsules out of a candy jar, he is under peculiar obligation to see that no man so called into the service of his country loses in the process any sovereignty as an American citizen or any dignity as an American man.
Now, wait a minute. I hope you haven't come on this program to suggest that ours should be one of those armies in which all authority is abolished. One of those communist pipe dreams in which all ranks are leveled and no advance is made at dawn unless the troops have first had a good long talk about it and decided whether or not they approve of it.
No, of course not. I'm all for discipline. The stiffer, the better. The distinction between officers and men should be sharp and continuous. The men in the ranks should, must, will give up every personal liberty which they have to give up in order to make the army a more efficient weapon. But at that point, the distinction should stop. And those are the better officers who never for one moment use that distinction for their own self-indulgence. And remember this. In all forms of society, there is a tendency on the part of the chosen few, often the temporarily and accidentally chosen few, to set themselves up as an aristocracy. You will observe this tendency in every army, in every division, in every regiment, in every camp. It should be resisted. Now, in the AEF, I did get a good worm's eye view of the American Army in action. I can and should testify that in the whole sensitive matter of the relationship between officers and men, the vast majority of our commissioned personnel obeyed instinctively the rules of fundamental decency. Most of them had as lively a sense of their obligation in the matter as the most idealistic Democrat could wish. Most of them. But not all. No, not all. On the laws of chances, the hierarchy of officers is sure to acquire some men of the type that always abuse their privileges. This happens in all armies. It did happen in ours. For the sake of the rank and file, as an implicit part of the contract the government makes with the homes from which the troops are drafted, such offenders should be watched. Watched. By whom? Well, to begin with, by the commander-in-chief, who, thanks be, is a civilian. Watched by the Secretary of War. Above all, watched by their fellow officers. Indeed, at the camps where, before another month is over, the first of these new officers will be trained, it should be part of the creed that an American officer would as soon take pay from an enemy or run away from a battle as he would take advantage, lazy, self-indulgent, self-important advantage of the distinction between officers and men.
Thank you, Sergeant Wolcott. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today was Alexander Wolcott. This is Rex Stout saying goodbye until next week.
You have just heard the 10th of a special series of programs entitled Speaking of Liberty, brought to you each week at this same time by the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the Council for Democracy, a national organization dedicated to the propagation of an American faith in democracy. Next week, Rex Stout will bring Mrs. J. Borden Harriman to the microphone. A copy of the script of this broadcast will be mailed free to anyone requesting it. The Council will also be glad to send information on its activities to any listener on request. Please address your letter or card to the Council for Democracy, 285 Madison Avenue, New York City. Speaking of Liberty has been presented as a public service by NBC and the independent radio stations associated with the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.